A very warm welcome. We're going to make a start. My name is Marcus Nodder. I'm the senior minister here at The Barge, London's only floating church. If this is your first time, you are especially welcome. Last year, we began a series of events called One Thing in Common, where we invited in special guests and to tell something about their different life stories and so on. Very different sort of people, different stories, but one thing in common, and that was their faith in Jesus Christ. And what we do is we have an interview for 20, 25 minutes, and then we have a talk for the remaining 10 or 12 minutes, which today is on faith in the firing line, and Colonel John Lewis is going to be speaking to us on that at the end. Our special interviewee guest knows plenty about faith in the firing line, so he commanded the first battalion, the Princess of Wales Royal Regiment Battle Group in Iraq in 2004. It faced the most constant period of conflict that any army unit, British Army unit, has faced since the Korean War. He's been awarded the DSO, Distinguished Service Order. He's an MBE. He served in Bosnia, Kosovo, Northern Ireland. Would you please welcome Brigadier Matt Mayer?
Thank you.
Our three-year-old came home yesterday clutching a little plastic tank and a little plastic infantry toy that he'd bought in a shop. There seems to be something magnetic about, certainly for boys, army and so on and soldiers. Did you grow up wanting to be in the army?
Yeah, I'm afraid a great lack of imagination on my behalf. So be careful where your three-year-old ends up, as it were. But I can't remember wanting to be anything else than a soldier. And when that, as I got older, particularly in terms of being an officer, the challenge of asking 30 young men and women on a dark night to go out and risk their life and limb just because you asked them to do so, I sort of thought, well, let's see how that works out for me. So that's what I did.
And how did it work out? So what's the reality like compared to, Iraq, we just say that as an example. Yeah. Your first day in Iraq in 2004, tell us a bit about that. What was it like?
The battalion arrived, the battle group arrived in Iraq at a time of increased violence. And actually on the very first day, I was out with my small group of three vehicles, nine soldiers. Went to a meeting, and then just down the road from where I was, some other soldiers of mine got into an ambush and took casualties. It is not normal behaviour, nor is it something I was seeking to do for the commanding officer at the grand old age of 39 to go herring off into these things. But I had a quick look. We were the nearest to the situation, so I grabbed the troops, including the regimental sergeant major, who was literally halfway through having his hair cut. He reminds me of that. He was literally went down the road into this firefight with half his hair cut. We went down this road, and I remember thinking, I can see it now, we went down this road, we had a river to our right, and we had a built-up area to our left, and there was just it sounds really surreal, but I suddenly noticed there were an awful lot of people firing at us, AK-47 fire. And we went under an underpass, and as we went under this, just this barrage of rocket-propelled grenades opened up. And I thought, and I'd never been under that intense fire, and I thought, this is not going to go well. But we broke through that ambush, and we got down the road, and I realised that, I said, well, that's fine, but that we need to go back into that to help these soldiers that were pinned down. So I got on the radio and said, right, we're turning around, we're going back into it. And that's when you find out whether the leadership works or whether the bloke's going to say, sorry, you're a bit difficult, I'm heading for the canteen. But fortunately, they did exactly what I asked of them. And we turned around, we went back into it. And then we spent the next few hours fighting around through back gardens and things like that. Until some armoured vehicles came along and got us out of trouble, and we sort of basically did, if you've seen the film Black Hawk Down, it was a bit like that. So that was the first afternoon, and that sort of set the tone for the next 7 months, as it were.
What's it like living in that sort of conflict for 7 months? I mean, it just tension day in, day out, stress. Do you get to sleep at night? I mean, what's it actually like to be there?
It is tense, obviously. I think the main difference between the reality and, say, the movie is that you know how the movie's going to end. The reality is you don't. You don't know how long it's going to go on for in terms of a period of violence. You don't know how it's going to end, either for you personally or more broadly. What I mean by that, I mean, I'm sure all of you have seen the film The Battle of Britain, you know, the famous movie, or been trapped on a wet bank holiday Monday and seen something or something like that. Well, you know how that film ends. The Royal Air Force defeat the Luftwaffe, the Nazis don't invade, etc. When you're there, you don't know how it ends. You don't know whether those mortar rounds that are landing now are going to continue all afternoon, or it's just going to be a blitz for 20 minutes. You don't know how that 7 months is going to turn out. So that itself has an enormous amount of strain and tension on you as an individual. And I was commanding 1,500 people, and then you're sort of slightly concerned about the decisions you're making, you know, minute by minute as to whether they're right or wrong. So, yeah, it's a pretty tense time.
I mean, you're not sort of selling it very well in terms of if, for me, as in, I wouldn't want to be in that situation. So, yeah. What's the good thing about it? What's the best thing looking back on your time, even in Iraq? What would you say are the real highlights for you?
The best thing about it, and yeah, you're right, let's not get depressed about it, there were good days. I wouldn't have done 10 tours and stayed around for a quarter of a century doing it. But the best thing about it is the people. I mean, absolutely. I've often said, you know, to quote Dickens, it was the best of times and it's the worst of times. And you see the very, very, very best of people in the most adverse circumstances. And the humour, I ain't going to find a word, but the humour that comes out of it and the comradeship is amazing. I'll go back to that first incident. When we eventually broke clean after this long afternoon and one of the guys had become a casualty, he'd been shot. Don't worry, he was fine. He actually ended up marrying the nurse that tended him, so... Yeah, they'll make a movie of it and... Brad Pitt will play him, but we actually eventually broke clean. We left a burning vehicle and we had a casualty. And before we'd gone, I said to the guys, the principle is basically sort of, you know, you smile until you have to shoot, but we're going to smile. We're going to be friendly. We're going to be open. It's their country. We were laying in this ditch, exhausted, dusty. One of the soldiers turned around to me, cigarette in his mouth, and said, "Are we smiling again now, sir?" And, you know, you just can't write that. What do you say to the guy? You go, yeah, Smith, we're smiling again. Right, just thought I'd check. So, you know, that's just a vignette. I'm not making that up. I'm genuinely not making that up. And it's that humour. It's great. Yeah, fantastic.
You were awarded the DSO, Distinguished Service Order. What was that for?
Well, technically, the official answer is it's for leadership in direct face of the enemy or something like that. But to be honest with you, it's a team award. I think it went to the unit for them standing through that period of violence, and I just get to wear it on high days and holidays on their behalf.
I mean, there are individuals who are singled out for special merit, aren't there? So one of your guys got the Victoria Cross, so the only one to be awarded during the Iraq War, and I think only 11 is it since the World War II, end of World War II. Mm. What was the story behind that, just briefly?
A couple of events that he went through. Young Private Bahari from Grenada, came up and joined the British Army. The first one was he's a driver of an armoured vehicle. It ran into a heavy ambush. The vehicle caught fire. He thought the commander and the gunner who were sitting above him in the turret are dead or certainly seriously wounded. He's got no communications. He can't go backwards. And the only way he could get these guys to safety was to go forward. But going forward meant driving down a road into another series of ambushes. There were barricades in the road, and there were obviously bad things going to happen to him. But he did that, and he put the foot down and went through it, got an awful lot of fire hitting the vehicle. It started to fill with smoke, so he lifted his hatch, stuck his head out to get visibility, promptly got shot in the helmet, took a round in the helmet. Kept driving throughout it all, got round outside one of the patrol bases, got out the vehicle under fire, got up onto the turret, got his platoon commander out, who was wounded, got his gunner out, who was wounded, and got them to safety, then came back to the vehicle under fire, and then disabled the vehicle so it couldn't fall into the enemy's hands, at which point he collapsed from exhaustion. Wimp. And then the second event, he went out on a dark night to intercept a team that were mortaring one of our bases. An RPG-7 was fired at him as he put his vehicle in harm's way and himself in harm's way. It exploded on his turret and he caught an awful lot of shrapnel in his head. Was severely wounded, evacuated to Kuwait, but lived. And as a result, was the first living Victoria Cross for 40 years. And I think I had the unique pleasure of telling a man he got a Victoria Cross, which is something.
Now, you're a Christian, you're a follower of Jesus Christ. How did that come about? Were you brought up in a Christian home, or it happened after that? Just tell us a bit of your story.
Yeah, no, I wasn't brought up in a Christian. I was brought up in one of those homes, familiar probably to many people here, where if you ask my mum and dad, they say we're Christians, in that we're not something else, but I wouldn't, you know, say a Christian. And I'd love to now tell you an exciting story of how 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon I was washing up and, you know, suddenly bang and it all happened. I wasn't like that. Mine was I think because I'm a man of, and pretty thick underneath it all, it took a lot of time, it took a lot of sort of erosion of my hard heart, it took a lot of questioning on my behalf, and then, almost academic, and then I suddenly thought, well, actually, yeah, no, there is evidence that Jesus Christ came to earth, the evidence of who he is and what he did for me, died for my sins, and now, Mayor, what are you going to do about that? How do you react to it? And so that's where I went from there. It was that sort of process, rather than, I'm sure there may be people here who have a much better story of it, that, but it was not a moment.
This was over a period of how long?
Two or three years, I would have said. Yeah. You know, fortunately, I was going out with and then married a woman who was very much a Christian, and she sort of kept me focused on that. In fact, she wouldn't marry me until I was a Christian. That's not the reason I became a Christian. Just clear that, clear that right from the get-go. Okay, it wasn't blackmail, but I was, you know, it was great.
And what sort of things did you do to find out more? Just if there are folk who, are that.
Yeah, I mean,
themselves.
I did, and I, you do it here. I think you do it here. Discovering Christianity.
Yeah, Christianity Explored.
Christianity
we call it now.
Yeah. It's called Discovering Christianity. There's a course you can do. I highly recommend it. Bring all your cynicism, bring all your questions, bring it all, and it's really, really good course. And this is what I did, and it's you can just ask any question you like, and the guys, whoever runs it here for your guys, they'll absolutely open, and you can ask any questions, and just throw it all out there, because it is something, it is a commitment, and you're absolutely right to answer those questions. So I did one of those courses, and that helped enormously, sort of put it together.
I mean, that meant that you were a Christian when you went out to Iraq in 2004. What sort of difference did it make, your Christian faith, to you in that sort of situation?
It makes a great deal of difference because, first of all, there are no atheists. I mean, there's a guy called Ernie Pyle, who's a World War II journalist with the American forces in Northwest Europe. He came up with this famous quote, "There are no atheists in a foxhole." And he's absolutely right, for one thing. And I saw that time and again. Because when you are in a combat situation, you are going to go down a dark road tonight, okay? There will be three outcomes. You will be dead, you will be maimed or seriously injured, or you will be safe, okay? Now, I don't mind, and nor does the bomb or the bullet care, how rich you are, what school you went to, who your parents are, whether you're the CEO or the janitor, it's the way it's going to roll. And there is nothing, apart from your military training, a stiff upper lip and a certain amount of character, but there is basically nothing that you can do about that. And all those status symbols are gone. So I found in those circumstances a lot of guys were looking for something. You know, what is that power? It's like sailors in a storm. It's, you know, everything's gone. Everything's out of control. I'm looking for something that's in control. And I didn't have to do that. Because it was, I knew what it was.
If we just move from Iraq to Bosnia, so you're awarded or made an MBE for your service in Bosnia. What were some of the highlights from that? What would you pick out?
Arresting war criminals. Loved it. Great. Really was.
Tell us a bit more.
Well, only because, you know, there is nothing more satisfying in life than taking down a man who has raped and murdered and thinks they're going to get away with it. And the surprise on their face when you nick them is brilliant. And so, and the whole thing about, to me, about the most satisfying thing about being in the British Army, two satisfying things, the people you work with, which I've already touched upon, and the fact that I spent my life being in five times Northern Ireland, a couple of times Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, turning up in a situation, generally it runs like this. There is a village, there is a town, in which people are trying to live their lives exactly the same as you and I, regardless of their belief, creed, background, anything. They all want the same, which is a better future for their children. They want employment. They want to put food on the table. They want to be safe. And they want a basic level of service, electricity, water. Okay? So that's it. We're all the same underneath that. And generally, by the time I turned up, some people had been preventing them from doing that through aggression. And to turn up in those circumstances and park yourself and then say to those men of violence, game change. If you now want to get to them, you're going to come from me, through me, and this is the best little army in the world, and we don't run. Do you fancy it? And that is hugely satisfying. That's great.
What's it like for those left back home, so your wife Val, when you're out in Iraq doing your stuff, what's it like for her?
Well,
I know she's at the back, we could get her up to interview her, but give us your...
I think she'll know what she'll tell you. She's utterly, utterly miserable. Yeah. Utterly miserable. I mean, the thing is that when you're in the fray, despite my first day, there were many days when nothing like that happened. Particularly. We had good days, we had bad days. And there are times when you're just kicking back, you know, like any office job, quite frankly, drinking coffee, you know, telling tales, ate a lot of ice cream. I remember about right. Ice cream became very important. It came up every day on the supply column, and if it didn't, we were miserable. It's a minor thing, sorry, a flashback. You think I'd have PTSD from something else, but it's the ice cream. but no, there were days of just routine office work and routine stuff. So I knew that. Val didn't, and your wife doesn't, and your wife thinks every day is like Band of Brothers, every day is like Black Hawk Down, and they're waiting for 7 months, day in, day out, night in, night out, that knock on the door that says he's either not coming home or he's not coming home in the same way that you left him. And that's awful for them. And, you know, just before she says it, I didn't help the situation. I didn't write a single letter when I was in Iraq to her. Okay, don't hiss. I did phone occasionally. In my bed. There's one thing. I did phone once, and actually, I don't know whether I've told her this. I'm just about to confess this. But she said, oh, what's that noise? And actually, what that noise was incoming mortar rounds coming towards us. And I think I said something. Someone's just come in the office and shut the door loudly. I must go. put the phone down, body armor, helmet under the desk, very ingloriously. But seriously, for those at home, it's that constant tension. Whereas for us out there, we know that sometimes you're just, you know, sunning yourself.
Richard Holmes, who's one of the leading military historians in the country, has written a book called Dusty Warriors, which is all about you and your battalion. Well, you and your battalion out in Iraq. Good read, do you think? Is it fairly, you know, gives you a good idea what goes on?
I'll tell you, I mean, Richard, who I knew, has died, but he was an absolutely charming, charming man and a great military historian. To answer your question, I'll answer your question in this way. The senior civil servant of the Ministry of Defence came into office. She came into office. She came from the Ministry of Justice. She knew nothing about the army. Okay, hold that thought. I was at a dinner when she turned up as a guest speaker. There was these sort of, you know, pre-dinner drinks, a lot of people standing around being very polite with a warming glass of white wine. We've all been there. And, of course, all the civil servants on this course, and I was the only military person, wanted to get FaceTime with the boss. Well, that's natural. So I said, that's great. It's there to introduce myself to their new permanent undersecretary. It's fine. So I sort of slightly stood back. I'm not modest, as you can tell, but I thought it was it. Anyway, she came in the room. She went straight to me and she said, "You're Matt Mayer." I thought, wow, I'm in trouble already. You only just turned up. It's from Justice that worried me. But she said, no, the point she said was that when she came into the Ministry of Defence, she said, "I know nothing about the army. I know nothing about operations. I know, you know, I'm a civil servant. What book should I read?" And somebody very kindly says, "Well, read Dusty Warriors, and it'll tell you what the modern army and what modern operations and what the young men and women go through." And I think that's the greatest compliment to the book. And she was kind enough to say she enjoyed it. So there you go. If you know nothing about modern soldiering and you don't, you know, at the sort of tactical level, I think it's quite a good read. And it's got the humour in it as well as the being shot at.
Jessica Ennis is doing a book signing in the Wharf this lunchtime, but I'm sure Matt will sign copies if you've got them. This is a library copy, so you can't have this one. Just a final question then. You had 27 years in the Army. You left earlier this year. What are you up to now?
I'm now the Director of Security for Canary Wharf. So you're now my villagers. And I've turned up in order to protect you from bad people. Hopefully should reassure you. But no, I started 2 weeks before the Olympics, which was a great time to take over. And I'm now basically Director of Security for that fine estate which sits behind us.
Was there any action during the Olympics that you can tell us about that, you know, just between us?
Us and a few dozen people. No, not at all. It all went extremely well. Very, very, very well indeed. And I think, anyone who was here during London, I thought it was a fantastic time. I thought the Wharf did really well. I think people on the Wharf were very understanding about the sort of the challenges of transport. So no, I really enjoyed it. I had a great time.
Can I say on behalf of everyone how delighted we are that you are now standing between us and any bullies in your office and protecting us. Thank you very much, Matt Mayer.
Thank you.
For our remaining few minutes, we're delighted to have not just one senior British Army officer, but two. So two for the price of one. So Colonel John Lewis is going to speak to us about faith in the firing line.
So you should have it on your sheets if you want to refer to them. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly." Jesus said to him, "Shall I come and heal him?" The centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him, "Truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Then Jesus said to the centurion, "Go, let it be done just as you believed it would." And the servant was healed at that moment. It's a wonderful story, and it's great to be with you. I can't really follow Brigadier Matt. I haven't had anything like such a distinguished career. I've ended up as a general staff officer. And, of course, we are all very conscious of our position in the Army. And I was in the mess the other day, and there were three officers there, obviously having had a good lunch, who were discussing which of their professions was the most important. One of them I noticed was the regimental doctor, Royal Army Medical Corps, and he said, well, sort of scratching back to his days at Sunday school, he said, well, if you remember from the early days, in early pages of the Bible, Eve was made from a rib taken out of Adam. So that's early surgery. So therefore, surgery and doctoring must be the oldest profession. And the engineer then thought about it and he said, well, you clearly don't know your Bible well enough. He said, if you go further back still, God created the world out of nothing. And out of chaos, he created the world. And that's early engineering. So engineering must be the earliest and oldest profession. At which point the general staff officer woke up and said, yeah, but who created chaos? For that, you'd need a general staff officer. So there we go. So there we are. There are all sorts in the military. But you might be intrigued that despite there being all sorts, there are men and women of faith in the armed forces. I came across this poem. You may have heard it read on Radio 4 the other day. It's written by a paratrooper and has been recently published. And you have to excuse the slightly earthy language in it, but this is a soldier's poem. Hello, God, it's me again. I know I only call when I'm really in the shit, but at least you know you're needed, and I'm not faking it. I've heard men call your name when they're about to jump. They promise never to drink again, to go to church every Sunday, if you'll only let them survive the fall and live to see another day. But with me, you know it's different. I only call when it's something really big. Well, God, today is one of those days. I know you're busy elsewhere with other more deserving lives to save, but you must have heard that great bang and seen the white plumes of Foss grenades. To say we're outnumbered would be a bit of a joke. The firefight's in full swing now. The air is full of buzzing bullets and thick with acrid smoke. I have two dead, and the four that are left, two of us are carrying fresh wounds. So as you can see, we're well in over our heads. I've spoken to Zero. He says they're on their way, but it could be some time, so it would be really good to get a second opinion as to whether I'll live to fight another day. Anyway, God, needs must, things to do and lives to take. Thanks very much for listening, but I suspect that the next time we talk, it could well be face to face. So there's a soldier and a soldier's faith of a kind. And you might be here today and you might be feeling a bit cynical about it and say, well, of course soldiers have faith. Soldiers are superstitious creatures. They're facing danger and perhaps death, and that's the way it is. But I thought that this lunchtime we might just look at the nature of faith a little bit, and particularly in the light of the passage that we read. The whole subject of faith seems to be a bit of a battleground in our country at the moment, and opinions seem more polarized than ever before. And I don't know about you in your workplace and the circles in which you move, but I come across a number of different sort of attitudes to faith. And I suppose the first one is just a contemptuous attitude, really, and it tends to come from those people who are or claim to be rationalists of some kind, perhaps those who have a scientific view. Richard Dawkins cynically describes faith as believing in something without any evidence or in the face of the evidence. Or to quote from the movie Miracle on 34th Street, faith is believing in things when common sense tells you not to. And some atheist philosophers have been even ruder, stating that faith is not wanting to know what is true. And I suppose in a way that's helpful because it focuses faith on truth. And faith is caricatured by such people as being for those with weak or lazy minds, or those who need a prop in life, or those who need to fill the gaps in their knowledge. And then I come across those people who are sort of vaguely envious about faith. They're the sort of people who sit next to you in a hospital waiting room or at a funeral and they say rather plaintively, oh, I wish I had your faith. But actually, they don't do much about finding out about that faith. And secretly, they think they're a little bit too intelligent to have your faith. And then there are those who do have genuine questions, those who are on a journey and are finding faith difficult. They would love to have faith, but they feel, and somebody said to me the other day, I feel like it's a one-way street, that I do all the talking, but I'm hearing nothing back. And I tried to encourage him to really listen and to seek. And then there are those people who have confused ideas about faith. And they believe in something, but they're not quite sure what it is. It's that sort of Star Wars faith. You know, there's a faith in a force. Well, I think there's something out there, but I don't really know what it is. I'm confused about it. I feel instinctively that there's something, a higher power that I should believe in, but I don't know what it is. When I attend funerals, you know, I'm quite often told that so-and-so has gone to a better place or is smiling down on me as we listen to Robbie Williams singing Angels. And people have a wishful thinking about these things. And then there is, I think, misplaced faith. And that's really people who often very genuine and very passionate about it, but they believe in fairies or Mother Earth or dead prophets or fake evangelists, fake religious leaders, muddled philosophies, all sorts of misplaced faith. And many of these people are well-meaning and they're sincere. But I think it was Billy Graham who told the story of when he was a child, his mother came to give him a spoonful of cough medicine and it turned out to be iodine. And of course, she was very sincere, but she was sincerely wrong. And clearly, it didn't harm him permanently. But you know, I remember that I went to an army recruiting office about 30 years ago, and we were filling in the forms, and the recruiting sergeant said to me, "Religion?" And I said, rather naively, "Yes," which was clearly the wrong answer. I was meant to say Church of England or Baptist or something. When he sort of finished rolling his eyes at me, he said, "Actually, it is important to have a faith if you're going to join the army. Faith is an important thing to get you through in difficult times." He didn't seem to matter to him what I believed in as long as I had some sort of faith. And that's the attitude of many, isn't it? It's helpful to believe in something. It doesn't matter that faith has to be real or right or based on truth. It's just a nice to have in difficult times. So what does it mean to have faith? Well, I was prompted a little bit to do this talk by a conversation I had in the officers' mess just a few weeks ago with two officers, one of whom fell into that category of saying, "Well, I'm a rationalist. If God is there, he needs to make it much clearer to me." And the other who had a sort of muddled feeling that there was something out there. And both of them seemed to think that faith was a bit of a leap in the dark. And both of them wanted a bit more light before they leapt. And I tried to explain to them that I thought that faith is not just a passive thing that happens when you least expect it, although some might testify to that. But actually, it's very much linked with activity. It's not a passive thing. It's something that has to be exercised. And in fact, the Bible tells us that faith without action is dead. Faith is inextricably linked with action. And it's interesting, I think it was Martin Luther King who said, "Faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the whole staircase." I think that's quite a good analogy. Imagine that you came to London from some faraway place, some remote place, and you're taking your first steps to work, and you find your route to work, and for some weeks you walk that long route to work, and you're becoming more confident by it. But you see these buses going by all the time. And other people say to you, "Well, why don't you catch the bus?" But there's these nagging doubts in your mind. You know, do the buses go to the right place? Will they run on time? Will they be quicker getting to work than walking? What if they get hijacked, or they go off route, or they don't turn up, or they go off course, or they break down? There are lots of people at work who never use the things. So why would I have faith to get on a London bus? And so one begins to do a bit more research, looking at the timetables. You look at the routes, you discover that the 51 actually drops off right outside your place of work, according to the timetables. You ask around other people. They testify to the fact that buses are reliable and they do go. And so you gradually gather the evidence. But there comes that point when you have to stand by the bus stop and you wait. And you're waiting for that 51 to come. And as you wait, the doubts begin to creep in. And then three come at once. And you step forward. And with faith, you step onto that bus. And as you step on that bus and you move off, you discover there are other people going to the same place of work. And they express confidence in the bus. And as you move forward and go on, your faith grows as you exercise it. I don't want to labor it too much, but you can see how that is very much like the Christian faith. It needs to be active. It needs to be exercised. One needs to gather the evidence, yes, but then to step forward in faith. The Bible doesn't offer conclusive, irrefutable proof for the existence of God. It takes that for granted. But the psalmist says, "Taste and see that God is good." The proof of the pudding, you see, is in the eating, not the looking. Well, we haven't got time this lunchtime to go through all the evidence that convinced me to become a Christian. But I think the evidence is out there aplenty. There is a huge amount of evidence for the existence of God, a God who is there and who is not silent, who has revealed himself in his word and ultimately in the person of Jesus Christ, who came to this earth to live as a man on this earth, to suffer and die and to take our sins, as Brigadier Matt has already described. And for me, all I can say is that I exercised that faith in the person and the work of Jesus Christ and have gone forward. And the more I go on and the more I go forward, the more convinced I become of the truth of it as the evidence grows in my mind and I exercise that faith. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Who did Jesus commend for having the greatest faith in Israel? Was it Peter who walked on water, or Mary or Martha? No, it was a Roman centurion. How extraordinary is that? A Roman centurion, a Roman soldier, not a Jew, a man who represents the hated occupying forces, a man who's an officer, a centurion, probably commanding 60 to 80 troops, roughly equivalent to a captain or a major in the British Army today, a man who would have been selected for his courage, for his integrity, for his authority, probably hardened by fighting. He'd probably seen men die. He'd probably killed and seen others being killed. He's a man of authority who expects to be obeyed without question. A man who says, come and he comes, go and he goes. He's certainly not easily duped or fooled, and I can't see him being particularly sentimental or irrational in his thinking. But he is concerned about his servant who is critically ill, and he comes to Jesus to ask for help. Now tell me this, do you think he came out of some sort of vague superstition? Did he come in the face of all the evidence, or as a great cop-out to avoid facing up to the reality of life? No, he came because of what he had seen and what he knew and what he had heard to be true of Jesus. So confident was he of Jesus' authority and power over death and evil that he even says to Jesus, Jesus, you don't need to come to my house. I'm not even worthy of that. Just speak the word and my servant will be healed. Jesus is so amazed by his faith that he holds him up as an exemplar against the religious leaders of his day. And that centurion is something of a faith hero of mine. First of all, he was an army officer, and I can, to a certain extent, identify with that. Secondly, he was what we might describe as a self-made man, a man of courage and integrity and authority, a man of ability. But he knew when he was beaten. He knew when he'd come to the end of his road, and he was prepared to accept when he needed help. Somebody's written this, the greatest act of faith comes when a man decides that he is not God. And thirdly, he cared for those people that he commanded. I think we were taught at Sandhurst, the motto was serve to lead. And this centurion cared about his servant, and he comes to Jesus. He recognizes who Jesus is, and he acts on it and comes to him for help. You know, I want to say to you this lunchtime that faith is not for those of weak mind and who are deluded, who want to dodge reality. If you're struggling with doubt this afternoon, I'd say this. First, go back and examine the evidence with an open mind. Don't be put off by the sarcastic pronouncements of the new atheists. Remember that an atheist can't find God for the same reason that a thief can't find a policeman. I would say to you, seek the truth with an open heart and a genuine desire for answers. Exercise faith by praying for faith. It was the disciples of Jesus themselves who said, Lord, increase our faith and be an active seeker. I think it was the prophet Jeremiah who said, you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. And that's my testimony, and I hope it's yours. Amen.